Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the podcast in partnership with the Emirates Festival of Literature and Megaverse. More about that later. Now, today's guest is the famous author Rebecca Yarros. She has gone from being a military mum living in different parts of the world, bringing up six kids, to being a global superstar author. Not only has that happened, her latest book is being turned into a TV series by Amazon. And that's just the beginning. She teaches us how to understand writing books, turning them into a business, and it's not as difficult as you think it may be. She suffers with ADHD, so she can't concentrate for long periods of time, and then she has to hyperfocus. So pay attention if you've ever wanted to write a book. Learn from Rebecca, because she knows exactly what to do, how to do it, and then how to make money out of it. Megaverse, the digital frontier of tomorrow. Megaverse stands at the cutting edge intersection of technology and imagination. It's a virtual realm where the limitless expanse of the digital universe unfolds, offering users unparalleled experiences and interactions. With its advanced metaverse platform, users can craft unique avatars, forge connections, and even establish their own digital estates. It's more than just virtual reality. Megaverse is an expansive digital civilization teeming with opportunities for both individuals and brands. From immersive concerts to revolutionary retail experiences, Megaverse is redefining the way we engage with the digital world. As we stand on the brink of a new era where the lines between our physical reality and the digital realm blur, Megaverse is poised to lead the charge in this brave new world. Dive in and discover a universe without bounds. This really is the future. Rebecca, thank you so much for coming to join us today on the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's not often we have a super mega successful author in the house.
I don't know if I'd label myself that, but thank you.
What does it feel like being as successful as you've become over the last few years?
Oh, gosh. Honestly, it's kind of the same in the fact that when I'm at home, I'm just a mom and I have six kids and I'm married to my awesome husband, and then I leave and come to book events, and it's a little different. But for the most part, I'm still just struggling to get my kids to hockey practice on time and, you know, get through deadlines. So it's I try to not let anything about it change anything about the kids in the house.
Talk to me about fans.
Okay. What would you like to know?
Well, I have some kind of notoriety here because I have this podcast that's quite well known. And so sometimes people in a shopping center will come up to me and say, hey, you're the guy that talks about X or Y online. I follow you. Yeah. Okay. Can I have a selfie occasionally? Yeah. When you're at an event like this, you know, Emirates Festival of Literature, and you're an author, there's going to be people that are here because they're here to see you.
That does happen. At least I know when you come to a book event or, you know, at conventions in the States or anywhere here like here, you're prepared for it, so you're ready. It's mostly people I'm not prepared for, like when I'm checking into the doctor's office and they've got, like, you know, a copy of Iron Flame. They're like, is that you? And you're like, it's a rare name. Yes, that's me. That's more what I'm not prepared for. So here it's like you can flip a switch and like, okay, I'm on and I'm ready to be present. When you're home in like a messy bun and a baseball cap and, like, you know, you're in a giant baggy sweatshirt, you're like, oh, yes, that is me. Sorry.
Where did your love of writing come from? Where did that journey start for you?
I've always been a reader. I think it comes from reading. So I was the dorky kid who got caught with books under their desk. Like, you know, like I'd be in math class and reading something else and getting yelled at for reading under my desk. My parents are both military, so we moved a lot, and they never censored what I read. So I read anything and everything I could get my hands on. And I started writing when I was younger. I won like a young authors contest for the Department of Defense schools because we were stationed in Germany. I think I was like 10, maybe 9. I'd have to look. But I have the cutest little bound book, and I misspelled author, you know, so my errors started early. And I love to see it. I came back, I wrote a little bit through high school, and then I didn't write again until I was, I mean, on and off as a hobby, but I didn't write again until I graduated college at 29.
Wow. I don't want to do the book thing for long.
So
we'll do the author book thing for a second, and we'll get into the bits that really matter to me. Okay. The first book that you read that had an impact on you, what type of book was it?
It was probably Chronicles of Narnia.
Oh,
and
really?
So it was fantasy, yep. It was in fifth grade. I loved it, and I raced this other kid through the series when we were at school because my parents had bought me a set, and he had a set. And every day we would get to school and be like, what book are you on? What page are you on? And it was like this contest between me and this kid to read it. But it was the first book that really transported me to another world. It's where I fell in love with fantasy.
So how old were you when you realized that you wanted to make this a career?
Oh gosh, probably like 29.
Okay.
If you'd asked me what my dream job had been or would have been, it would have been writing or telling stories for a living.
Yeah.
But we got married super young and we had a lot of kids super young and my husband was in the military. So we moved and he was gone. And it just seemed kind of like a dream that was never going to be, you know, actualized. So I think he was on his third deployment to Afghanistan and I wrote a page a night. Because I just graduated college. It took me that long to graduate college because when you move base to base to base, you lose your credits. Mm-hmm. And you have to start all over again or, you know, bring in new credits. So I wrote a page a night while he was gone. And when he came back, I said, hey, I wrote a book. And he's like, you what? It's like, all right. And he, you know, I love him. He didn't balk. He didn't say what. He sat down and started looking at agents with me and started, you know, helping me figure out what to do with that book.
Wow.
Yeah, he's a
and so you got
partner.
This book. Was he the first person to read it outside of you?
Yeah, he always is.
And so when he read the book, was he typically a good husband who said, that's great? Or was he critical? Or did he give you areas of critique? How did it work?
Looking back, he was a little bit of both. He would kind of say, like, how do you feel about this part? You know what I mean? And I would kind of give him my feelings. But he's always been super respectful and never pushed boundaries. Kind of like... if he's a helicopter pilot. So I certainly didn't go to work with him and be like, are you certain that's what you want to do at this moment? Nor would he look at me and be like, are you certain that's what you want to do? So he's kind of my number one cheerleader. But because my first book was urban fantasy and it didn't sell. Mm-hmm. And that happens in the industry. My second book was a military romance. He was definitely key because I could ask him details. I could make sure it was authentic as possible. And because it was the life we lived, in that respect, he'd be like, no, this is wrong. Or no, this is what the radio call would be or something like that.
It's nice to have a husband that understands it from that way, because I'm sure there's people out there that have written a book and their partner's gone, well, that'll never work. You'll never get anywhere.
I've seen it.
Yeah, that mm-hmm. won't even, what are you wasting your time for? You know, go back to your job being a project manager or secretary or whatever, nurse, whatever it may be.
I've seen it, but he never once questioned me. The first writer's conference I went to was the day after Hurricane Sandy. And all the flights were canceled because the airports were underwater.
Yeah.
And he was coming back from like across country with his helicopter and he had to land it, drove up, got me, dropped the kids at his parents' house in Pennsylvania and drove me into the city so I could be there for that conference. So I wouldn't miss that flight. He's been nothing short of the most supportive partner ever.
Tell me about your confidence. Do you feel like you're a success? Do you feel like you're not successful yet? How do you process what you've done and what you've achieved?
It's surreal. I mean, I've been writing for 10 years and published for 10 years, but the success of Fourth Wing and Iron Flame has all happened in the last, you know, 6-7 months. So when you go from having a readership that's like, you know, this a very small but dedicated readership to blowing up per se, like is what's happened here, it's really just surreal. Like it doesn't really register. At moments it does, but for the most part, it doesn't. It's like
so you're
I'm living
not, you're,
someone
you're
else's
not, you're
life.
Not in the mirror, you know, in the morning, flicking the hair, going, oh, I made it, you know?
No, I'm more like, you know, coming down the stairs and then being like, you have two interviews. And I'm like, oh gosh, okay, all right, let's see if I can, you know, not stutter over my words. No, I'm not. Every morning I get up and I think my first thought is, what time is it? Are the kids out the door? Because my husband is a stay-at-home dad now. And then it's usually whatever needs to get done for work and I go to my office. It's not.
I love it though.
No, I would love to say, yes, I look in the mirror and I'm a superstar, but no, I mostly look in the mirror and I'm like, how far are you behind on that deadline? You know, because I juggle two contracts right now. So it's mostly just trying to ignore everything else around me so that I can remain authentic to my writer self and make sure that everyone else's opinions aren't bleeding in. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? So I try to shut out the world as much as possible. Honestly, I don't read anything about me. I don't listen to anything about me. I don't look at articles or TV shows or anything. I ignore it all. It's somebody else.
Talk to me about gratitude. What kind of a role does that play in your life?
Huge. Absolutely huge. I think the first thing we did when I got a call about what my royalty payments would be was we called our kids in to the kitchen, and we said, what teacher made the biggest difference? Because all four of our boys go to the same school. Our daughter's special needs, so she can't go there. But, you know, what teacher meant the most to you? And they told us. And the very first thing we did was we called the band director. And we said, we're going to make a donation. And it was the best feeling ever to know that, you know, there were certain things that he'd wanted and could finally have. I'm immensely grateful I can send my kids to college. I'm immensely grateful that that Violet, the main character in Fourth Wing, speaks to people. You know, especially because she has Ehlers-Danlos and I have Ehlers-Danlos. That was, I'm not going to say a gamble, but it was a very tough decision for my publisher to say, yes, let's go ahead and do this, because chronic illness doesn't, you know, isn't something you see a lot of bestsellers with.
No.
So it's unbelievable gratitude and a lot of pinching myself, honestly.
I think that gratitude is something that when I was young, I mean, I'm 53 now, but when I was young, it was a term that was used, you need to be grateful, young man, but it was something that was never that real, because you were still kind of wrapped up in the hustle of the next step, yeah, next, you know, the next phase or whatever that may be. So you weren't stopping to have a moment and try and understand where you were and realize how lucky you were or grateful, yeah, you should be. But as I've got older, I've understood the vital importance of that in my life, for me to just stop. And I've worked with lots of kids that have come from difficult backgrounds. And some of these kids are born into abject poverty, born into horrible situations. And somebody said to me one day, they said, your worst ever day, Spence, is a dream,
yeah,
beyond their best ever day.
Absolutely.
And it made me stop and think that, hold on a minute, I need to stop and be a little bit more grateful for what I have.
Yeah.
And that's when the kind of like the change happened for me. Okay, talk to me about the business of being an author.
Okay.
Because being an author, a lot of people can say very easily, well, that's an artist, you know, that's not an operator, that's an artist. And you may have heard this type of stuff.
Yeah.
But I believe that whatever your profession is, whether we're making parasols out there, whether we've got a dhow boat business going across the channel here, or we're in the business of writing books, there's a business there, and there's all of the challenges that I would expect every business has that you go through yourself. Talk to me about a day in the life of being a business person rather than an author.
Sure. I joked with my husband that the business of being me takes about half my day right now, because it's no longer just writing books, or, you know, turning them into publishers, or going through edits or anything like that, or promo. It's very much, you know, where is your company? What type of company have you formed? Do you have the right, you know, do you have a film attorney? Do you have this attorney? Do you have this agent? Do you have this? And where are we spending? How, I have a business manager for that. I have a business manager and two assistants, thank goodness, because I am never the adultiest adult in the room. I have ADHD, so inattentive type. So there's every chance that I will think of something and then it will just flit right on off. And so my business manager will take that and make sure that comes to fruition. It's very much, I think in a business sense, just making sure that you're managing royalties how you can, and where are you investing your time and your effort, because we are artists, but we're also the product makers.
Mm-hmm.
So what we invest in is, which book do we write next?
Mm-hmm.
Where's the market headed? Which is going to be, you know, what is the story of my heart versus what's the story that's going to be marketable? And sometimes you have to make a choice, and it's not a fun one.
Okay, well, that's an interesting point, because it's like a musical band. They come up with two tracks. They love one track, but the management team are saying this other track is going to be the one where the money is. That's the cash track. I know, but you love that track. I know your passion and your heart. Mm-hmm. You can believe that's a better melody in there, but this is the money shot.
Yeah.
That's the kind of conversation you have to get into.
Yeah, it's hard. I have two books that I wrote that never published. They sit in a desk drawer. I call them my desk drawer books. I just, you know, I open the drawer and I pet them every now and again. I'm like, this is not your time. And I shut the drawer. But usually at this stage, I'm where I can go to my publisher with a pitch and say, hey, this is kind of what I want to write. And they'll take a look at the market and say, we think this is what's going to do well. And you just hope, you're really hopeful that what you want to write is what's going to be marketable. Because if not, it's very painful. It can be a painful process to try and write a book, at least if you have a track. You've already made the track, it's already done. But when you're doing this with a book, you have to wade through and get the book written.
So in that process, then, are you suggesting to make sure I understand it correctly, that you have, let's say there's two ideas. Mm-hmm. It's essentially, it's the ideas stage that they're like, take that path.
Yes.
It's never the finished manuscript.
It's no, that's not, it can be the finished manuscript. At the stage of my career I'm at, I can typically say, go to either one of my publishers. I have two, and I can say, I kind of have this idea that I want to write. And they can say, absolutely. Or sometimes they'll say, okay, well, we're seeing a trend here, or is there a way to twist it here? Or can we speak to your base here? Because of course, branding, I hate that word. Mm. Branding is always brought into it. Is this your brand? Is this what, you know? And that was what was so dangerous about Fourth Wing, was it was not, it was not my brand. So, you know, is this your brand? Is this where we can go with this? You can absolutely write a manuscript, query it to your agent, take it to an agent, go get it published or self-publish. All methods are valid, but it where I am at, or how I like to operate, is really go to my editors and say, this is what I want to write.
What you did was almost like J.K. Rowling writing an autobiography.
With?
Whoever that may be. It's almost like them going from one genre and saying,
oh,
I'm going to write an autobiography about this person. It's like, no, J.K., this is your space.
I got you. Okay. Kind of.
Because it's different from the other stuff.
Yeah, it is different. But at the core, I mean, it still revolves around military. It's a war college.
Mm-hmm.
And I've primarily written military romance books. And it was my same publisher. It was something I'd always wanted to do. My very first book was urban fantasy again, and it didn't sell. So I wrote Full Measures, which was my debut, on kind of a fluke. My husband was going on another deployment, and I just had these emotional questions I wanted to ask myself of if I would be willing to love a military man if I'd known what path we were headed on, because we were married before the day before 9/11. So, you know, everything kind of changed there. So urban fantasy was my, just where I loved to be. So knowing that Red Tower was going to come out and do fantasy, that was my publisher. I could go to my editor and say, hey, I want to do this. She knows my writing style. She knows my voice. And she said, okay, all right, you want to do this? You bring me five pitches. Bring me five pitches of what you want to do. And think about not just thinking of one book idea or one fantasy world, but five. I had to come up with five.
Wow.
And then pitch them to her. And then we got on a call and I wrote them. I gave them to her in the order that I wanted to write them. Like, this is the book of my heart. This is the book I could have fun with. This is the book that, yeah, I think this could be great fun. This could be fun. This could be fun. But they were in the order. She picked number three.
Oh, really?
She did. She was like, I love the dragons. And I'm like, the dragons? Like, you, I mean, my jaw dropped. Do you love the dragons? Really? Because that was kind of like a wild card. I had thrown that in as a wild card. She's like, yes, we're going to go with dragons.
Do you take that one person's opinion, or does it need to be for your own kind of like confidence and comfort? Does it need to be four or five people saying dragons?
Depends on the stage, the publisher. In this stage, it was Liz Pelletier, who's the head of Red Tower. And she had been my editor before, and she was the one handpicking the projects to be put out by Red Tower. So when she says, we're going to go with dragons, I say, okay. And then I get behind, I look at my pitch and I say, yeah, all right. And then you fall into that world and you create that world.
You mentioned something a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. You said you had ADHD.
Yeah.
And the way you just describe what happens to you, we're twins. Okay. From that point of view, I have exactly the same thing. Okay. I can be deep in thought about something. Okay. Have then to send a message to you, let's say. And by the time I go to send the text to you,
it's gone.
I'm like,
yeah.
Haven't got a clue.
Yep.
What was it I needed to send Rebecca?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then 3 days later, it'll pop up as a photo that I took a screenshot of something, yes, that actually was meant to be sent to you.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'll respond to text messages in my head. Like, I'll think I texted back, but I didn't. I just think I did. And all my children have it. My husband is the only neurotypical person in our house. So when we try to have like a family meeting of what's about to happen the next week, it's like wrangling cats. Because everyone is everywhere and we all just follow each other's trains of thoughts. And my poor husband's like, okay, back to center. Back to center. Who's got practice on Tuesday? He's trying to like wrangle us in.
Have you ever forgot to pick up any of the kids from school?
No.
Okay.
No.
Never got that one wrong.
No.
My mum did. My mum did once.
It happens.
I still remember.
Yeah.
Because you're a kid and you're 6 years old and you're at school and everyone's gone home and you're sat there, mm-hmm, with a teacher and you've got some crayons or whatever it may be, until what appears like an eternity. It was probably 10 minutes.
I know. But you feel like it's been 40 forever. Years.
You don't love me
anymore.
Yeah,
I know. You think you've grown old in that moment. Yes. Disillusioned with the world. I know.
So then, I want to stay focused on business, but I really need to understand this. Yeah. ADHD, what you've described, I understand like exactly. Mm-hmm. How does that ever cause you a problem when actually writing?
All the time.
So you're all like in the moment, in that thought, storyline in your head, getting it down, whichever format you're using in that time. And then all of a sudden, gone.
Yes. So the, it's funny. The heart of accessibility or the heart of Fourth Wing is really accessibility. So I basically give myself accommodations that I need. So I understand that I can hyper-focus because I was diagnosed late. My son went through diagnosis and they started talking about the ways that women present. And my husband looked at me. He's like, it's you. And I'm like, oh, okay. All right. Maybe. And I looked at my doctor. I'm like, that's impossible. I write books. And she's like, well, how do you write a book? I'm like, I don't know. I can write a book in a month. And then I don't write for a few months and I write a book in a month. She's like, yes, you hyper-focus.
So you're able to do that.
Yes.
Let's just explore that a bit here, because that hyper-focus mm-hmm. is for a period of time or on a particular thing?
It's usually on a particular thing. You know, it's like an area of interest. And
you become obsessive about it?
Yeah. I live there. So when I write a book, I live there. I see my children and my husband, of course, but my mind is always in the book. So when I'm in the middle of drafting, that is where I live. Everything about the world is inspiring what I'm writing, or I'm relating it to the book, or I'm still in the book's playlist for music, but I live in that book because I'm hyper focused on it.
And is there anything that can knock you out of that hyper focus?
I have six children.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah.
I always tell my kids, like, I said, trying to get to work for me on a day that my brain is not hyper-focused, and of course I take medication, is like going through airport security. It's like going on a trip. And I need to write in Dubai. But I have to get to the airport, I have to get through security, I have to get on the airplane, I have to get to Dubai, unpack, and then begin. And when the kids have, you know, because we have Ehlers-Danlos, you know, broken arms, sprained ankles, anything like this, the things that will just pull me straight out, I have to go back and restart again and kind of roll through. Even them just walking into my office, I have to not get sidetracked by whatever it is they're telling me, but yes, 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 absolutely. And then remember to pull myself back.
I think that people will find a lot of reassurance, because if you can suffer with what you suffer with and you're able to deliver what you deliver, then there'll be people out there that will have had a belief system saying, I can't do this because.
You can.
And you yeah, exactly, you can do this because, yeah.
You can. Things that help me are, you know, because thoughts, my brain just goes and goes, right? So when I'm writing and my brain is going and going, I'm hoping it's not going on a different project, otherwise the day has gone askew. But I keep a pad of paper next to me and I write down whatever has just come into my head. And I just write it straight down. And that way I can tell my brain, it's like the book, The Art of Doing Things. Mm-hmm. I write it down and my brain lets it go. So whatever it is, I write it down, push it away and keep going. And then if something else pops into my head and tries to steer my focus, I grab the pad back, I write it down, I push it away and I focus back in.
Your husband's in the military.
He's out now.
Your husband was in the military for a number of years. You've mm-hmm. lived in these different countries.
Yes.
You're a published author, but you're not making the millions yet.
Yeah,
okay.
No.
And then, but you're getting a lot of juice from the fact you're doing it and you enjoy it and you're making a living, yeah?
Yeah.
And then in recent times, it then accelerates like crazy. And all of a sudden, there's a few more zeros on the end of things. We don't have to talk about the numbers. there is more than there was before. Let's put it that way.
There's more than there was before.
Do you have any ambition to be rich? Do you have any ambition to be financially secure anytime soon? Do you think about that kind of stuff?
I have the ambition to make sure that my mortgage can be paid, my kids can go to college. Again, our little one has special needs, so a lot of expenses can come in there, and all of my children and I have Ehlers-Danlos. So at any minute, our joints dislocate, our bones break. One of them could go out of work, one of them could go out of school, I could go out of work, things like that. So I always have the ambition to make sure that we are secure. And I have the conscience to make sure that I'm not the only one who can be. So I feel as though the more I begin to make, the more we need to give. Does that make sure? Mm-hmm. So like when I sat down and I did my business plan this year for the five things with my business manager, one of those five things was making sure we identify causes that, you know, we believe in and that our family comes together in and we can donate to those causes. And it's been great to ask my kids, like, what's important to you? Where do you want to donate? Where do we want to get back? But yes, of course, I think everyone wants to be financially secure. I think that's a common.
Yeah, look, nobody doesn't want to be financially secure.
Yeah.
However, most people are, are not entrepreneurs. Most people have got a steady job with a steady wage, and they have to factor their whole life into that steady wage.
Yes.
The savings every month from the salary, the mortgage, the yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, we're white collar gamblers.
Yeah. What a great thing to say.
We are. We just gamble with our time and our effort. And where do we put that? What's the gamble on? Is the gamble on book A or book B? Where does your effort go? Where does your marketing money go? Are you going to traditionally publish that book? Are you going to self-publish that book? We gamble. And we're only paid every quarter. So we have to, you know, we have to get very good at budgeting. Otherwise, you know, by the end of the month, ooh.
So. What's your feelings towards the majority of publishers out there as businesses? Do you like them? Do you find yourself frustrated by them? How does it work?
As they're all listening. Honestly,
so for all publishers out there,
I've only had two. One I've always considered, you know, my home, because it's where I started and it's where I've ended up with Fourth Wing. And I have Montlake as well. Everyone's very kind to me. They've been very considerate. I think that when you build your own platform, or, you know, that rising tide, if you can help that tide rise, you're going to get more support from your publishers. I do think that they've been nothing but supportive of me. I will say that. I think I have a lot of friends who are extremely, extremely successful self-publishing. And I've done it a couple times. I am not smart enough to handle all of self-publishing. It is a business in and of itself, but I've done it twice. I've had some success. My first bestseller was a self-published book. So I like them, but I also like not putting all of my eggs in one basket. So I like knowing that I can self-publish, that I can switch, that I can move a publisher, that I can, you know, the business is not the publisher. The business is me.
Understood. Okay, let's move on to the last part here.
Yeah.
You're going to be making one of your books into a TV show.
I am. Well, I'm not, but yes.
Okay. It's is that the kind of like, I've arrived moment? Is that the kind of, oh my gosh, I don't know about that. I'm not sure about that. It sounds like a good idea, but oh.
It's still in the surreal territory. I have yet to wake up. I mean, yes, there are moments where I'm absolutely just knocked on my butt by gratitude and like, oh my gosh, is this real? But I'm still very much in the, is this real phase? Every aspect of it. So we knew about Fourth Wing being picked up by Outlier and Amazon. Gosh, I think they read the first draft. So I was sitting in a meeting where they were, you know, kind of talking with us, and I was getting, you know, kind of like very nervous. And they mentioned something. I'm like, well, that's different. That's not in that draft. And suddenly I realized they had the first draft. And I wanted to just disappear into the floor. I wanted to just fall straight through my office chair to the floor and not exist anymore. But they, I'm glad that they picked it up. So I'm very excited.
And so what's the challenge? You take a book, you've written it, and then it needs to go to become a manuscript.
Yeah.
Okay. And that manuscript is a very different version of the book.
Screenplay. Yeah.
That screenplay, is that somebody else saying, we'll turn it into a screenplay? Or is that, Rebecca, can you make that a screenplay, please?
Someone else is turning it into a screenplay. And I'm really lucky. The production team is very hands-on with me. I just had two meetings with them last week. So they're always keeping me informed about what's going on. And they're so kind and so lovely. And I they give me all the warm fuzzies. They're very protective of it.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me about the emotions around that. How does it feel? Okay, I know you said it was surreal, but how does it feel? Let's be realistic here. You've gone from this lady that got married young, okay, husband in the military, traveling around the world, and these wonderful experiences where lots of Americans don't travel around the world, and growing your family. You're 29 years old. All of a sudden, it's time to start writing. You publish, okay. Hey, happy days. We've got some publishing done. Yeah. Okay. Not making a fortune, but making an income. Then you go into this stratospheric level just in recent times where it really accelerates for you. And then the success just grows and grows and grows. And then it's this stage of going to a television show, a series. And that's going to be something that people that don't read are going to consume. And you could take a million examples, whether that be The Hunger Games or whatever it might be. That puts you into a whole different league.
It kind of does.
Your body language fascinates me. It's kind of like, oh.
I know, it's terrifying. There's a lot of this is terrifying. A lot of it is, you know, you know, your platform growing from 15,000 Instagram followers to almost 500,000 in 7 months, or a lot of, you know, the examinations or the interviews where you can absolutely make a fool out of yourself. A lot of it's terrifying. So I am utterly grateful when I'm home in my living room with my children and I'm safe and secure and just with my dogs, you know what I mean? But then there's a lot of it that is mind-blowing and really hard to wrap myself around it. And I remember talking, do you know Colleen Hoover? Mm-hmm. So I called Colleen the week before Iron Flame released her Friends. And I was like, I can't do this. Like, this is, everybody wants an interview. Everybody wants me here. Everybody wants to see this. And I'm not cut out for this. This is not okay. And she was like, it's going to be okay. You're going to need some therapy. And I was like, okay, all right. And she's like, and you're going to have to get to a place where, you know, you can be okay with people having misinformation about you or saying things that aren't true and you just being peaceful about it. And I said, great. How long is that going to be? And she's like, I'll let you know when I get there. I'm like, great. Okay. So it's going to take a minute. So it's a different stratosphere, but at the heart of it, it is really just me and my husband and my kids at home with our menagerie of pets. That is real life. Everything outside of it happens outside, but real life is inside my home.
Your husband's in the background right now, and while he disappeared off for his walk, you spoke about him in such a beautiful way.
He gets so mad when I talk about him too.
it's the relationship that you have with him clearly it oozes out of you, and it's beautiful to see. So I just wanted to say
like
that
each other.
While he was in earshot,
we like each other.
He's what we would say in London, a big old unit. So. Okay, two questions before I finish.
All right.
Number one, there's people right now listening to this that are like, I want to do that. I want to make it in that industry.
Do it.
Where do I start?
Okay.
And I know this is going back into this world and I want to stay away from it, apart from this one thing.
Okay.
There are so many people that don't know where to start. You've made it in the best possible way. You've been on a journey. Okay. What do we say to these people? What do we teach them? What are the three most important things, the two most important steps, the thing that you say, you must do this, guys?
You have to put your butt in the seat. So people who are like, I always want to write a book, you have to sit down and do it. And I come from a world where, you know, I was privileged that my husband worked. And I was working too, but my husband carried the majority of our family. And I wrote a page a night. And I was decorating cakes. And so I would finish decorating cakes at 1 a.m. I would write until 2 a.m. I would get up at 6:30 with the kids and go. I did that for a year. The end of a year, I had a book. It's not the healthiest way to do it. I would not really recommend anyone go on 4.5 hours of sleep to do it, especially those of us who are chronically ill. But you have to put your butt in the seat and write it. You can't go look at agents or publishers or marketability until you have a product. You have to write the book.
It's interesting because to me, that's a lot like business. It's like, you say a page a day. Mm-hmm. When we establish goals for any form of business, we might take a 12-month goal, but the most important thing to do is remember that 12 months is a long way away and you can't see the finish line.
Correct.
So break it down.
Yep.
You know, and I always break everything down into 90-day goals.
Okay.
So, because I can see 90 days.
Yeah.
And then I divide it by 3 to get my monthly goal. I divide it by 4 to get my weekly goal.
Yeah.
And then I divide it by 5 working days to get my daily goal.
That makes sense.
And so then I work out what the action is I need to take to achieve the day's goal.
Yep.
The one page a day.
One page a day.
There is nothing that stops anyone doing one page a day. And I know there'll be people right now going, hold on a minute. How many kids have you got? Let's just remind everyone.
6. Well, okay. I had 5 when I wrote my first book. I had 5. We hadn't adopted our daughter yet.
Okay, so 5 right. kids back then. Okay, mm-hmm. So now I just want to make sure that everybody listening to this, there's no excuse if you've got kids. Okay, so that's part of that. But also, you might not be able to do something every single day.
Correct.
But you know what? How about think about 7 pages a week?
Yeah.
I bet you've got 3 hours to write 7 pages, for example. Mm-hmm. You can catch up. It is possible to do.
Yes.
And you're a living example of that with your first book.
It's incredibly possible to do. You just have to set that tiny goal every day so that it grows into the bigger one over the year. And I'm at the point where I can write a chapter a day, so I can write a book, you know, depending on if I'm not traveling. I wrote the last letter, I think, in like 3 weeks. So you get faster. It was a hyper-focus. So you get faster and faster, but a page a day at a year, you have a book, as long as you haven't like meandered off into like, you know, some 1,000-page tome, you've got it.
Okay, last questions, yeah. Because they're things that you and I are aligned on with philanthropy, mm-hmm. And what we care about. Yeah. My life changed when I started focusing on trying to help others. Before, it was about me, my success, what I could achieve, how I could go for it, you know, sleeves rolled up, you know, stiff upper lip, get stuck in, make it happen, rah, type of stuff. Gotcha. Yeah, which I'm sure you've met many people like that in your lifetime.
Always.
But then I started to look at how I could make a difference to others. And it was by accident at the beginning, but it filled me with so much joy and got me out of my own head that I now think that it should be law that everybody on this planet spends 1 half day per month volunteering.
Yeah, our kids do. Their school makes them, okay. Which I'm glad. I mean,
because I just think that half day volunteering will remind you how lucky you are, yeah. And help you to make a difference to somebody else.
Yeah.
And I believe most of the world's problems will be solved if everybody was just kind to one person.
I agree.
So tell me what you've done and how you were inspired to do the stuff that you do.
With our nonprofit?
Yeah.
So we have a nonprofit called One October. And when we started fostering our daughter, she arrived. They called me and said, we have this baby. She needs a temporary placement. My husband happened to get on social media. He was in Afghanistan at the time. It was like this just moment of blind luck that he was there. And I said, should we take this baby? So temporary placement. And he said, yes. And I said, okay, but we're going to the hockey rink for practice. And they said, we'll bring it to the hockey rink. And I said, like a pizza. And they said, yes, like a pizza. We will bring her to the hockey rink. And I said, okay. So I put my kids on the ice. I walked out with my little two and they handed me who would become our daughter. And she didn't have a lot with her, which I never blame biological parents for. That is such a traumatic event that's happening to remove a child. I can't imagine trying to think of everything you want to pack for your child. So once they say, hey, this child's going to stay with you for at least this amount of time, I look and I'm like, well, gosh, we were fostering toddlers. So here I am with a baby and, you know, no high chair. The crib is set on toddler setting. No swing, no anything. I remember my son, our second son, holding her on his lap while I made lunches in the morning because I didn't have anything for her yet. So we started One October because our daughter's special needs take up the majority of our time. And we want to make sure that we just don't have the time to focus on fostering another child. It wouldn't be fair to them. So we said, what can we do? And we said, we can solve the problem of kids coming into the system with nothing. So a foster family can call us and they get an unmarked duffel bag. That way that child isn't stigmatized for being in care. With a week's worth of clothing, mm-hmm. and shoes and whatever else we have. Mm-hmm. We have backpacks, we have school supplies, things like that. We have a lending closet, so they can call us and say, I have a baby and I need a crib, okay. I have a baby and need a swing, okay. And I need them. Hopefully they bring those back and we can keep them in the lending closet. But it was mostly to alleviate that need and to help kids enter the system with dignity so that they could, because some kids come into care and they have to go to school the very next day. And if they haven't been sent with anything, what are they wearing? Mm. So we're trying to help the kids navigate a system with dignity. That's it.
You're just one heck of a lady.
I don't really know about that.
Well, you are. There's a lot of people talk and then there's few that do. And the ones that do are the ones really that have got the halos because they're the ones that are the angels.
I don't know about a halo, but I think you just find what you're passionate about and who you can help and then you help. I think there's too many people, you know, who are out there saying they want to help without just doing the work. I think you do the work.
So simple, isn't it? Just to summarize, you want to write a book, page a day,
yeah.
Get your bum in the seat, do the job.
Yeah.
You want to get involved in helping others? Roll your sleeves up, go do the work.
Yeah.
So simple, and yet for so many people, it doesn't happen, but you made that difference. Rebecca, I can't thank you enough for coming to join us on the podcast today. I know it's boiling hot where we're sat
here.
We've got a great view.
Cherry tomato red at this point, but we got it.
I hope you enjoy the rest of your stay in Dubai.
You.
I hope you enjoy the Lit Fest. And yeah, one last time, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.